The military and food stamps. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, May 25th. Thanks for joining us this Memorial Day. As is tradition, President Barack Obama went to Arlington National Cemetery to lay a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Across the country, there were parades and services. But aside from these collective moments of remembrance, the everyday lives and struggles of those who serve or who have served in the military can be forgotten. Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk joins me. She's here to talk about a hard reality for some military families and veterans. Turns out there are a surprising number of servicemen and women on food stamps. Hi, Chrissy.
Hey, Adrienne.
So you've been looking into some statistics when it comes to current and former members of the military who rely on food stamps. What have you found?
Yeah, so every year the USDA publishes data about where food stamps are being spent, specifically what kinds of stores. And there's a bunch of different categories: grocery stores, big super centers, convenience stores, farmers markets, all those sorts of things are on the list. But also, it might startle folks to know, military commissaries are on the list.
And those are the stores on military bases.
Right. These are the stores that sell groceries just above cost. You can shop at a commissary if you or an immediate family member is on active duty or is a reservist in the military or the National Guard or is a military retiree. And last year, more than $84 million worth of food stamp benefits were spent at military commissaries. And that's just, of course, a fraction of a percent of all the food stamps spent in America each year. But when you think of who is doing this spending, people who served or are currently serving our country and still having trouble making ends meet, that number is pretty sobering.
It is. So we know how much they're spending. Do we actually know how many military personnel and veterans are on food stamps?
Well, the numbers are actually kind of hard to come by. Neither the military nor the USDA, which runs the food stamp program, neither of those agencies keep a tally of the military status of every single person on food stamps. But recently, the USDA estimated that between 2,000 and 22,000 active duty military members.
So they really don't know.
Yeah, that's a big range. And that was for 2012, which is the latest data they have. But that adds up to about 1 to 2% of people in active duty who are on food stamps. And when it comes to veterans, the USDA estimates there are more than 1.5 million vets on food stamps, or about 7% of all veterans.
And remind us, how low does your income have to be to qualify for the food stamp program?
Pretty low, though it depends on how big your household is. A single person has to be making less than about $15,000 a year. For a family of four, the threshold is about $31,000 a year.
And what do you make in the military these days?
If you're a very junior member of the military, your annual base pay is about $18,000 a year. Add in bonuses and housing and food allowances, and it can go up to the high 30,000s. But if you've got a big family, that's not a whole lot of money. You might very well qualify for food stamps, or at least be struggling to get by. I spoke to a woman named Jennifer Dalen, who grew up in a military family herself, and now she runs a set of food pantries near Camp Pendleton, the Marine Corps base north of San Diego. She serves a lot of active duty military families, and here's what she told me.
Often people are really surprised that it's even needed. They're like, they don't need that. That doesn't happen. But it does. When unplanned costs arise, someone needed to get new tires for their car or had an unexpected pregnancy, it's difficult to handle them considering the financial situation that they're in.
And then Dalen told me there's also the fact that in the military, when you're moved around a lot, it can be hard to maintain family and social support networks.
So people who are in different states than their parents, than the kids' grandparents that was providing support for them emotionally, financially, you know, just with coping.
It's interesting, Chrissy, because you've reported a lot about the growth of food stamps among working people because their pay is low. But you think of that mostly as a private sector issue, retail and service jobs, things like that, not a military job paid by the government that we count on.
Right. And on the one hand, you can look at the issue of military personnel on food stamps as kind of an academic issue, because after all, it's all government money. So does it matter if lower paid members of the military are getting some of their money through food stamps or through their paychecks entirely? But there's certainly those who say military wages, especially for the most junior members, haven't kept up with inflation. And for people serving our country, that is concerning.
Thanks, Chrissy.
You're welcome.
Memorial Day marks the unofficial start of summer, the unofficial start of the summer driving season, and it seems the unofficial car recall season. Last week, the Japanese auto supplier Takata doubled the number of airbags being recalled in the U.S. to 34 million. General Motors continues to deal with fallout from a problem with bad ignition switches on millions of its cars. It all raises the question, how exactly does a company manage to stay in business when it's recalling so many of its products? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
Recalls happen all the time.
Oh, yes, there's thousands every year.
Jonathan Bernstein is president of Bernstein Crisis Management. There were a bunch of recalls just last week. A stove that turns on by itself, a weight training bench that can break. And big recalls cost billions, especially when there are lawsuits or fines involved. And yet,
it's extremely seldom that a recall leads to the ruin of the company.
There are a few reasons for that. Take GM's recalls last year of 30 million vehicles. First, it's not like GM handed out 30 million new cars.
Yeah, almost always in the case of a recall, it's just a part getting fixed.
David Whiston is an equity analyst with Morningstar. GM's fixes have cost $2.5 billion so far and shaved profit. Costly, but not company ending. The other thing is between lawsuits and repairs, recalls take a while. So does paying for them.
The financial damage gets spread out a bit over time. It's not all at once.
And if it has to, a company can take on debt. In the case of Takata, it has an extra thing going for it. It's one of the few companies that make critical safety equipment for automakers. Dave Sullivan is an industry analyst with Auto Pacific.
The company's essential for the auto industry. They really have to survive. They're too big to fail.
And for many companies, the longest-term damage from a recall can be to brand reputation. Sullivan says it's not like consumers will ask for cars without Takata airbags. It's not like Takata's a household name, although now that could be changing. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Wall Street was closed today, but we'll take a look at what happened overseas when we do the numbers. Bourbon, love it or cough at the mere thought of it, is America's whiskey of choice. But how exactly did it earn that honor? Reed Mittenbuehler has written a new book, Bourbon Empire, The Past and Future of America's Whiskey. Hey, Reed.
Hi.
So for us bourbon novices, of which I am one, what about bourbon is distinctly American? Why is it an American whiskey?
Well, George Washington actually made a version of whiskey at Mount Vernon. Hmm. But as you see Americans settling west into the frontier where more corn is growing, corn starts working its way into the mix. Bourbon is made primarily of corn, at least 51% corn. It made a lot of business sense, too. There wasn't a lot of other use for this grain, and it was a way for farmers on the frontier to kind of store the value of their currency, and they'd use this whiskey to trade. But over the course of American history, the industry consolidates. By the year 2000, you have 8 companies, 13 plants, and they make about 99% of all the whiskey in America.
Wow, 99% of the whiskey in America is made by these 8 companies?
Right. And that needle, it's changing a little bit. We've just in recent years had a craft distillery boom. The numbers are still a little smushy, but it's about 600 new distilleries have popped up just in the last half decade. But still, they are under 5% of that overall number.
So that's interesting, because when I'm sitting at a bar looking at the beautiful rows of bourbon bottles, it all looks like each bottle was crafted by hand in some very small, loving way. And you're telling me that's completely not true.
It's completely not true, but it's also not necessarily a bad thing. It's funny because, right, I feel like you puncture a lot of things. You puncture this sort of illusion for a lot of people. You go into the liquor store, and there's a million different, you know, labels, like you said. And it looks like there's one individual, you know, wearing overalls, and he crafted, you know, what you have.
All of these are coming from farmhouses or something.
Right. And for a lot of people, that's sort of where the story ends. They feel duped. It's like, what? You know, I'm being lied. This product is just made by a giant corporation. But this is, for me, where the story really began, because those corporations, they actually do a very good job.
Huh.
And they're sort of an outlier in the food world and, you know, a lot of the popular conceptions we have about food. You know, we're small is best. And that's not to diminish, you know, today's craft distillers. They're reintroducing a lot of old things that have been lost, but not without some obstacles, some roadblocks. It takes a lot of capital to do it very well, and sometimes they struggle with that.
Why do you think bourbon is gaining in popularity now?
Well, you know, two reasons. Well, three if you want to include the simple reason that it just tastes good. But in a lot of ways, this resurgence in popularity of bourbon is a return almost to normal. America was always a very heavy whiskey-drinking nation. And then in the 1960s, 70s, you see this market just crater and it plummets. As a lot of baby boomers turn away from it, it was seen as an old man's drink. It was kind of fuddy. It was blue-collar. And they turned toward things like vodka and these lighter drinks. So it's kind of a rejection of what had come before. And then today, I think you see a lot of people sort of rejecting those boomer drinks, vodka and the lighter drinks, and they're returning to whiskey.
Having written a whole book on bourbon and tasted a lot of bourbon, are you done with bourbon?
No, maybe I'm just beginning.
Really?
No, I mean, I've been to the mountaintop, so to speak, you know, and I think I disappoint people sometimes when they ask for recommendations. You know, they expect me to give them some very esoteric answer, like, I climbed to the top of a mountain, there was this old guy there with a beard, and he was like, I'm going to bestow on you a secret, you know, the best bourbon there is. And you kind of realize after you've been there and back that there's a little bit of this populist element to bourbon. You know, it doesn't have to be expensive to be good. Older isn't necessarily better. It really kind of finds its sweet spot in the middle somewhere where it's accessible, affordable, and easy to find.
Reid Mittenbuehler is the author of Bourbon Empire, The Past and Future of America's Whiskey. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How about we taste some bourbon?
Okay.
Reid talks me through a bourbon tasting. It's on our website, marketplace.org. And spoiler alert, it did not go well. Coming up.
My parents was like, hey, are you doing all right? You want money? I was like, I don't really need money. If you want money, I can help you, actually.
A story of entrepreneurship in Iran. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed today for Memorial Day. The U.S. has marked this day in some form or fashion since just after the Civil War, but it took an act of Congress to make it a national holiday. That didn't happen till 1971. So how'd the markets look 44 years ago? On Memorial Day 1971, the Dow Jones Industrial Average stood at 907 points. By comparison, Friday close was 18,232, an appreciation of just more than 2,000%. Many European markets were also closed for banking holidays. However, those that were open took losses on continued concerns about Greece and its ability or inability to pay its debts. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Wondering how the manufacturing sector is doing? Great news. The Commerce Department will report on last month's durable goods. NASA is planning a mission to Jupiter's moon and will announce its selection of instruments for the spacecraft. And if you've got a sweet tooth, go on and celebrate Blueberry Cheesecake Day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill. John Nash, Nobel Prize winner, died in a car accident along with his wife on Saturday. He was 86. Nash was a professor of mathematics at Princeton. He became a household name when he was portrayed by Russell Crowe in the Oscar-winning film A Beautiful Mind. Tim Fitzsimmons reports on Nash's lasting contribution to economics, a deceptively simple concept known as the Nash Equilibrium.
John Nash was a mathematician, not an economist, but the phenomenon he described, what's today known as the Nash Equilibrium, has had a massive impact on the world of economics and social sciences. Around the end of the Second World War, a new school of research called game theory was gaining steam in academic circles. Dale Jorgensen, a professor of economics at Harvard, says academics were excited by the field, but
there weren't really much evidence that this was having much effect in the way people thought about strategic situations.
Or to bring it to a level we might understand, initially, game theory was about zero-sum games. If one person wins, another loses. Nash provided a mathematical way of understanding games that more closely resemble the real world, where we don't necessarily have clear winners and losers, says author Alex Bellos.
I think people think, when they look back at the Nash equilibrium, they think, my God, this is so simple. It's amazing that it was so groundbreaking because it seems so obvious. And it seems so obvious because it's just become part of culture.
Today, game theory is used to describe myriad social phenomena, business, politics. Bellows says every time someone says zero-sum game, they owe a little credit to Nash. Roger Meyerson is today a professor of economics at the University of Chicago. When he started his academic career in the 1970s, Nash's work had started to mature, but Nash had withdrawn from public life as he battled paranoid schizophrenia.
And at that time, I knew he was alive, but there was no hope that we could ever meet him.
While he was ill, his ideas had radically altered the entire field of economics.
It's moved economics from a focus of resource allocations to a focus on understanding how behavior responds to incentives.
After Nash re-entered public life in the 1980s, he was famous. In 1994, he won the Nobel Prize, and in 2001, his life story was fictionalized in the film A Beautiful Mind. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Memorial Day is typically a big weekend for movies. This weekend, though, not so much. The estimated box office totals this year are as low as they've been since Memorial Day back in 2010, in part because people didn't rush out to see Disney's tentpole, Tomorrowland. Movies that disappoint are clearly bad for the studios that make them, but can also hurt the movie theaters that show them, especially if you're a single-screen theater and you've got just one shot to make the weekend pay off. Which is why we went to the Vista, a single-screen theater in Los Angeles built back in 1923. They made the call to play Mad Max for a second weekend. Lance Allspaugh is the owner. I met up with him in the lobby between screenings.
It's kind of an Egyptian meets Spanish motif. Back in the day, in 1923, right across the street where there is a supermarket, the set of Intolerance, the movie, was over there. And if you see that movie, there's a lot of this type of decor that was in that film, mm-hmm. and the builders got inspired by that, hence the look in the auditorium and hence this Egyptian vibe that's going on here in the lobby.
Do you mind if we walk in and look at the theater?
Yeah, want to go into the auditorium?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Right this way.
Do you watch every movie that you show?
No, I don't. There's some movies you just know that you're going to play no matter what, right? This is one of them. I knew we had to play Mad Max, and I said, I'll catch it. I do tend to watch the movies that are questionable. You know, if you're not sure that you're going to play something, you need to go see it, because if it's no good or if you don't think it fits this audience, then you want to not play it. Because that's the other thing, is you can't make a lot of mistakes here. Because
right, you can't that one book, screen.
Yeah, you can't book the wrong movie, or you're going to be slow for a week or two. So it's very important to try to always be right.
So you're airing Mad Max. This is its second week. How did you choose that?
Well, Mad Max has an enormous cult following. If you know anything about the general audience that comes to the Vista, they're all into that sort of thing. They're into edgy, eclectic, arty, big screen affairs. And Mad Max on this screen, in this venue, that's definitely what it is. You're not going to get this kind of Mad Max experience elsewhere.
Now, Mad Max has good reviews, but how did you know that, one, you wanted to choose Mad Max, and two, that you'd want to extend it? Or are you extending it? Did you book it for 2 weeks?
No, we booked it for 1 week. Tomorrowland was supposed to open on Friday, and Disney was really counting on it opening. And what happened is that the movie opened here and even exceeded our predictions.
Mad Max opened here.
Yes, and what happens is that when you open a movie, you tell the studio that if it grosses X amount of money over the weekend, we're going to hold it. And if it falls short of that, then it's out. And that's always the deal. And we set a figure that we thought was surely, there's no way it's not going to make more than this, but it exceeded it by like $15,000.
Wow.
And so you can't go to Warner Brothers and say, you know, could you please let us off because Disney really wants, I mean, because, you know, if Disney had a big hit here, like let's take Maleficent last year, that did huge here, and they held. And so, you got to be fair.
So, but what happens? So you call up Disney and you say, sorry, you're out this week?
We say, you remember what the holdover figure was with Warner's? And they say, we already know, because everybody gets the numbers on the industry sees what everybody does. And they already knew. They knew what we were calling about. And they said, look, if we did what you did on Mad Max, we would be wanting to hold. So they quietly walked away with their tail, you know, tucked in. But this movie did tremendously well.
Right.
Just astoundingly well.
Now, so, Pitch Perfect 2, though, did better. Did you have a moment where
you're
like...
Well, but you see, now, isn't that interesting? Because, you know, Pitch Perfect, which I'm sure is a marvelous movie, is not going to play well here. First of all, it's a dialogue-driven comedy. And this is a very big room. And comedies do well here, but they have to have kind of an edge to them. And okay. Pitch Perfect is a very kind of... You kind of know where you're going to go with it. It would not have done what Mad Max did. There's just, you know, yes, it did well in the nation. It did much better than Mad Max. But Mad Max here is the difference. It's not so much the movie as you've got to tie the movie to the venue.
Any just tremendous mistakes where you just made the wrong call?
Oh, how much time do you have? Too many to count. I don't know off the top of my head what the last bomb was. But yes, sometimes you put something in and you think, oh man, we're just going to clean up with this. Right. Put on 6 people, get 2 managers, and then you call. How many people do you do? 60? Oh, okay. That was 60 just for, no, that's the whole day. Okay.
How is the sort of move to movies online and even this talk of movies premiering on streaming services, how does that affect a theater like this, or does it not, because this is such a different experience?
It's not. You know, movies, day and date on the internet or online or on television or VOD, video on demand, is not, there's no way I can stand here and say that's a great thing. It just isn't. I think it's lousy that they come out on DVD and video 90 days after their release. That's quick, I think. But you cannot get this experience at home, and
right.
You can't get it on your little iPhone.
And do you take comfort in the fact that this is an experience in a way that few places are?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, you want it to be, because what else can you sell? You've got to sell the seat, the screen, and the sound, and then the atmosphere, right? There's nothing else to sell here. And the customer
and
service.
And the popcorn.
And the popcorn. Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. That's right.
Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
I appreciate
it. It's nice
it.
To meet you.
Nice to meet
Thank
you.
Thank you very much.
We've got a video on our website that'll take you inside the Vista and give you some more of its history. That's at marketplace.org.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy.
Over the past few weeks, we've been trying something new. We're taking a book edited by Merritt Watts called First Jobs, True Tales of Bad Bosses, Quirky Coworkers, Big Breaks, and Small Paychecks, and calling up the people who contributed the stories. Today, a young man who couldn't find a job in a small town in Iran, so he decided to start a business of his own.
My name is Sharuz Varshavi. My first job was actually printing student projects. When I was around 17 years old, I got accepted for a college to another city. But I was feeling so bad about the situation because I was coming from like a sort of poor family. I didn't want to have like pressure on my father's shoulder and stuff like that. I was trying to come up with something that can make money for me. And after a while, I realized that there are like so many students, including myself, that always looking for print shops because we are graphic designers and we needed to have a high quality printers to just print our stuff. I thought that it would be cool if I can buy a printer that kind of solved the problem. I realized that the price of the printer is like same as 1 month rent. I paid my rent to buy a printer actually. And then when I got the printer, it was really exciting for me. I told my friends that, hey, I have a really high quality printer. You can do your stuff with my printer if you want to. There were like so many students. I was getting famous in like other universities and people were saying that, hey, this guy is printing really great. I made so much money and I was like so happy. My parents was like, hey, are you doing all right? You want money? And I was like, I don't really need money. If you want money, I can help you actually with it. If you're struggling about something or what, you could definitely make it up. It doesn't matter because I literally started from zero and I made like so much money that I paid my tuition, like my rent, and I bought a car and had like some savings. So just gave me so much confidence to do whatever I want to do for myself. I know that there is no limit now.
That was Shiraz Varshavi. He now works as a graphic designer in New York City. He still keeps his old printer at his parents' house in Tehran, by the way. This final note, it's a cable company eat cable company world out there. We've got news today of a potential $55 billion deal between two of the four largest cable companies in the U.S. Charter Communications wants to gobble up Time Warner Cable. You might remember that Comcast failed in its bid for Time Warner after regulators were unhappy. Official word on the Charter deal could be out tomorrow. And of course, we'll be watching. All right, that's our show for the day. Wall Street was closed for the holiday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Austin Cross, Robert Garova, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Adrienne Hill. I hope you have a great Memorial Day. Kai Rizdal will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.